Thank you, John. Sarah, thanks for people joining us. Sarah's a friend of mine, and what drew me to her and her work initially was the search for an alternative journalism, that somebody would be willing to do investigative reporting, but on things that work and things that are possible in this world. And so, in a way, I love what she created and what she's doing now, because it's an antidote to the fear-based reporting that, that most of us have unfortunately gotten used to. Also, I'm part of her People's Hub. And the other thing that I think is innovative about what you're doing now, Sarah, is that we know that in every community, something's going on that's creating an alternative future and more of an indigenous restoring our humanity, however you would describe it. Except there's nobody to tell the story. There's nobody to connect these communities. And so if there is a movement happening, you connecting these people who are making changes in communities and giving us the support and the skills. I know John has always said that the hardest thing about being a pioneer is the loneliness. And so part of what I think you're doing now that I hope we'll get to is helping pioneers in neighborhoods, in local communities, reduce their sense of isolation and loneliness. Because if you do work on the edge, you always think you're crazy. And your parents will confirm that. And so thank you so much for being here, Sarah. Maybe you could start by saying what's captured your attention now, and how did your journey that you took change your life and your thinking? I thought we'd start with an easy question.
Yeah. Yeah, so I took a road trip in 2015. I spent 4 months living in a little pickup truck and camper, visited Cincinnati, so I saw Peter while I was there. And I was visiting communities all over the country that normally don't get in the news. Their stories are usually not told. I was especially looking at places that are struggling, like Appalachia in the South, and places like Native American reservations and Rust Belt cities. And everywhere I went, I was asking, who has solutions here? Who's coming up with some ways forward? Because it seems to me that the big status quo institutions, whether it's government or the big institutions of higher education or the nonprofit industrial complex, somehow the solutions to the big crises of our time are eluding them. And I thought, well, maybe it's happening in the margins where we aren't paying attention. So I spent 4 months going from town to city to tiny little backwater community and finding amazing stories of what people are doing. And it's true, a lot of those folks feel isolated. They feel like, you know, maybe they and a few of their friends are the only ones doing anything. And then I tell them about another place I had just visited, and they'd say, oh, I want to meet that person. And I started thinking, that should be so easy to do. You know, with the internet, it's so easy to introduce people. Nobody has to actually travel. We could get on a Skype call. And that idea was what created the foundation for People's Hub, which is my next project.
Can you describe People's Hub a little bit?
Sure. So the idea is that people, as you said, people everywhere are working on these kinds of innovations and new solutions, and people everywhere are in despair about how bad things have gotten and wanting, many, many people are wanting to get involved. I was so struck by the Women's March right after the inauguration when millions of people, there was 4 million people, and they were in communities, over 300 communities around the country, who stepped up to say that they cared and wanted to do something. And once they got done with that day of being on the streets, the next question is, well, what can I do where I live? How do I make something happen here? And it just seemed so clear to me that power that people have in their own communities to get stuff done, if we can unleash that power, we can have a real transformation of this country. And not the kind of top-down transformation that I think is so problematic. Top-down has so many so many pitfalls in terms of people getting power hungry and corrupt and getting it wrong or privileging one subsector of the population over others. But from the bottom up, there's this enormous possibility for creativity and democracy and so forth. So I kept wondering, so if there's all that possibility and all that interest, what is holding us back? And it seemed to me that there are several things. One is people are, of course, busy. They go back to their stressed lives, trying to make ends meet and raise their children and so forth. And that's a given. But there's some other things, too. There's people not feeling capable, not feeling that they have the skills to make things happen. Maybe they've tried getting involved in their community or tried holding meetings and they went badly and they ended up saying, oh, I'm just never going to do this again. Or they got into some kind of a conflict and they didn't know how to navigate it. And I kept thinking, you know, there's skills to doing these things. They're not rocket science, but we're not born knowing how to do these things either. So what if we could transfer those skills from communities where people have gotten some pretty good ideas of how to navigate them to places where people are eager to learn? So that's the idea for PeopleSub, is to connect people online so we don't have all the expense and the scarcity, essentially, of travel, because when you travel and all the expense that goes with it, you can only go so far. But what if we did it online? And there's no stopping how many people can be involved in transferring this kind of information from one community to another. And what if we train people not as individuals, but in groups where they live, so that as they're learning, they're also getting to know each other better, and they're sharing the learning together. And at the end of a series of trainings, they can look around the room and say, okay, we're the ones that know how to do this. We're the ones that are going to get something done. Let's go. So that's the idea, is that the isolation you were talking about, I think, is the isolation of people at the edge, but it's also pervasive in our society. I think we've gotten to such a toxic level of isolation that is actually making us mentally ill in the United States. And so we need to be finding ways that we can be together in physical spaces, not through social media, but actually be together. So we want to train people in groups together, even though the person that's doing the training or the people doing the training may be anywhere in the United States.
Now, can you carry that forward so that we could see how it works in particular? Let's imagine I'm in a small town and ran into something about the possibility of having a time bank. But I don't know much about how it works or what to do. Is your site a place for me to go?
Absolutely. So some of our trainings will be somewhat generic, like how do you have a meeting where you come out feeling energized and heard and ready to take action, or how do you navigate conflicts? So some of the trainings will be generic, that things that any group might want to know how to do. But other things will be much more specific. So we may have a trainer as part of our we're thinking of it almost as open source. So a trainer who may be primarily affiliated with a time bank, but they come onto the People's Hub site now and then to give trainings on how to start a time bank. And if we don't have that, you can also contact People's Hub and say, this is what I'm interested in, and we'll try to find somebody through our database who you can work with directly.
That's a wonderful idea.
You're really shortening the learning time between when I hear about something and when I can talk to somebody about it.
That's right. I think we're kind of running out of time in our society. You know, this summer with all the wildfires out where I live in the Pacific Northwest, or the hurricanes, these should be wake-up calls. Or the election of Donald Trump, for that matter. These are wake-up calls that something has gone badly wrong in our society, and we don't actually have all the time in the world to fix them. So I think we need to take very seriously the time scale that we have to really step up to these issues. And I think scaling horizontally is a way to get that work done.
Right. Well, you know, what I was thinking, I wanted to get your reaction. You know, the traditional conversation is top down and bottom up. But I think lateral is probably where the movement occurs. It's because as soon as you say bottom up, it means that we're starting at the bottom, but we've got to get up. We've got to reach the people so-called in power, and maybe making them irrelevant is what a movement really does. And so you're creating a vehicle for, just as you said, a kind of lateral, horizontal connection. Reduce my isolation. find me somebody to talk to, listen to people that are through it. So it's really a lateral movement rather than bottom-up, top-down. Any thoughts about that?
I think you're absolutely right, and that's very helpful to hear it described that way. Yes,
yeah.
I think it's true that a lot of the folks that are in power are too married to the status quo to be ready to accept the really radical kinds of solutions that we need. And I'm talking about things like time banking, you know, things that are fundamentally changing the story of our society and the story of our communities so that they are, in fact, about building on the abundance that we have instead of using scarcity as a way of concentrating wealth and power. So too many people at the top are already married to and are benefiting from the status quo. They believe it's inevitable. They maybe want it to be inevitable. I'm not saying one way or the other about that. But a lot of other folks don't see it that way. They can see that that's not working, and they're very open to and maybe even eager for something that is fundamentally very different and very willing to be creative. So at the grassroots, we can spark that creativity and do that kind of experimenting.
Sarah, I think you've got history going with your analysis, because I'm old enough that I remember when there was no civil rights movement, but you could go to any town or city, a neighborhood, and you could find a little group of people who were concerned about civil rights and were beginning to try to do something, but they were not connected. And what made the civil rights movement into a movement was that there were tens of thousands of little groups of people who were working in their vineyard to do what they could about their situation. But the movement was a process that connected them all together so that they could learn and have the kind of power that they'd never experienced before. And, you know, they were creating a new way. And I think this idea of connecting local initiatives for learning and for increasing power has such a great history that you're right on point in what you're doing.
That's good to hear. It's been really interesting how excited people are once they get the idea, whether they're people who see themselves as potential trainers or people who say, oh, I want to take a course in that. And oftentimes it's both. It's someone who says, you know, I know a lot about this thing, but wow, I would like to learn about that other thing. And that's, that to me is a sweet spot, because none of us know everything. So we can all learn, but we don't have to feel like, oh, I'm a passive recipient of somebody else's wisdom. And we don't have to feel like, oh, I'm the big shot who has all the answers. We can all be in a learning process together. And I just think that's a really exciting space to be in.
You know, the time banking John mentioned, this is for people who might not know, it's a way of tracking generosity. So if I do something for you, groceries, so walk your dog, I get hours so in my bank. So it's most care in the world is not monetized. And so this is a way of tracking non-monetized care. And one Edgar who created this particular one, has the notion of co-production. And, you know, you mentioned the non-profit industrial complexes. I thought that was an interesting phrase you might say a little more about. But basically, this hub that you're starting could be an example of co-production, where half the time I'm learning and half the time I'm teaching. And it's true for everybody who joins. And I think that really glues us together, so we don't, you know, have a bunch of learners and then you got to go find experts. But there's a co-production quality to that.
That's right. And one of the things we're hoping to develop is also a text-based forum. So if you're in a community and you run across a particular problem or have a particular question, you can put it up on that text and on that chat, and then have someone else come in and say, oh, we ran into that in our community. Here's how we handled it. And people can weigh in and have that kind of conversation. So, yeah, I think that co-production is a really really helpful way to think about it.
Sarah, as you took this trip, you found in various places all kinds of local initiatives. You found initiatives around food and new co-ops being formed and urban farming and restorative justice programs, place-based economic efforts. Did you see anything in common in terms of the people who tend to do this kind of innovation and production?
Well, I hadn't really thought of it in terms of the people, because I talked to people who are young and old and people of all races. And I guess the one thing might be a little bit of optimism that things could go better if with some effort and a willingness to sort of step out and play some kind of a role in that. But it wasn't necessarily beyond that. It wasn't necessarily any particular kind of people, I think. Just maybe people who also had the experience of knowing that there could be other ways. So for some people, it's if they've spent a bunch of time in a very different culture, they can look back at their own culture and say, okay, that's one way that things could be. But we could actually do them a different way also. So for a lot of people, it's that kind of ability to step back from wherever they are and take a look at how they're living and how their community is living and say, you know what, I think things could be a little better here. So for people who've been marginalized, for people of color who've been on the outside their entire lives, that's really clear. For people who've been raised in more privileged circumstances, they may tend to feel like, okay, the status quo is working okay for me. But nowadays, the status quo is working for fewer and fewer people. I mean, even folks that are still in the middle class, their level of security has been really undercut by a number of the economic policies that concentrate wealth and power in a few hands, and so many other people then feel like it's just one pink slip and they could be, you know, losing their home or one medical emergency and they could lose all their savings. So I think more and more people are sort of taking that step out of the matrix, if you will, the notion that our way of life is the only way there could be, and saying, you know, I think things could be different, and what would that look like? And I think they get very excited when they see other people in other communities who are doing those kind of, taking that question and making some stabs at some very tangible changes that open up other possibilities.
Another thing I was wondering about, in this lateral world, as Peter describes it, there are people of all kinds of political persuasions. I think about some of my own relatives. They're involved in employee-owned ownership and are very interested in kind of food-generating activities, and they voted for Trump. And what I'm wondering is it possible that at the level where you are exploring and where things are associational and face-to-face and are about, in a sense, a common good, that this whole world that you're exploring might also be the place where we're most likely to see the bridging across what seems to be a terrible divide. Do you see any of that?
Yeah, I think that is the best place to do it, in part because I think when we're with other human beings, it's harder to escape the fact that they're complex and we're complex, and even if there's one area where we have really strong disagreements, there may be all these other areas where we can empathize with those other people. And I think it really takes being physically with other people rather than being on some kind of social media fighting with each other to have that experience. That said, I think this country has a serious, I'm not quite sure that's a word, but a seriously toxic question around racism,
mm-hmm.
and also gender exclusion and sexism. So those are issues that can make it really unsafe for people at the local level as well as at the national level,
mm-hmm.
because there's violence associated with those those prejudices. You know, there's violence, there's exclusion, there's impoverishment, and that the history goes back a very long time, and racism especially, but also violence against women seems to be provoked, especially during economic hard times, which is where we are and where we're headed. So I think, you know, when I was doing my road trip, one of the key questions I was asking everywhere is, where are communities succeeding in taking on these questions, especially about racism? And it seems to me that communities are having some real successes, but they're doing it very deliberately. They're not just expecting that will happen as a byproduct of working on other issues. They're consciously taking on racism as a central question. Whatever the demographics of their particular community, they're taking that on as a separate question that needs to be addressed in a really forthright way.
I think in addition to race, you know, economics is really that's breaking apart. And do you imagine chapters of People's Hub in Cincinnati? Because, you know, even though it just happened to be where I am, it's just kind of a medium small town. But it's very hard to wire together and connect. You know, if you took a neighborhood and added up all the people who are trying to make that neighborhood better, there's something just elusive to me. Like, I haven't found a mechanism to say, well, suppose we organize our efforts around the neighborhood, and maybe the People's Hub, once you get the infrastructure down, is a way, and I think you said this, that may help me meet face-to-face with all the other people that are trying to create an alternative economy, an alternative food hub, you know. So I think there's great possibility in that. I don't know if you think in that way, Sarah, but your national thing may ultimately lead to deeper localism, local connections.
Yeah, and the focus is very much on people getting the training in local groups. So
yeah.
what we'll ask people to do, even if an individual comes to us and says, you know, I'm tearing my hair out, I want to make change, I don't know what to do, we'll ask them to please find three or four other people where they live or to join a group where they live and then do the training together, because that seems like where we have the most potential to really make change is in those place-based communities, in neighborhoods or towns. It's just too abstract and too much sense of powerlessness when we only intersect with national organizing. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I don't think we're going to – I mean, this could change. I don't think we're going to have chapters of People's Hub. I think what we're going to want to encourage is people to create whatever they create at the local level that we then support with resources and training and, you know, connections to other communities. So, for example, in your neighborhood, perhaps there would be a group that would be made up of a number of different neighborhood groups that would come together to have a conversation with somebody over the internet, a trainer somewhere else, who
yeah.
might be bringing some ideas that are really useful and be involved in some kind of training process with that person. But in the end, it would be turned back to the groups that are already in existence or for whatever they choose to create next.
Right.
Yeah.
So let me go ahead, John.
I was going to say, Sarah, your book reminds me that another traveler in 1832 went to towns and villages and cities around the United States, and his name was Alexis de Tocqueville. And what he found was what you found, that the primary building block for the society at that time was small groups of people who he named associations. And he said, what makes America powerful and unique is that we don't have much associational life in Europe, but in the United States, we do have strong associational life. We know from Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone that it may be declining some, but I think you've taken that Tocquevillian journey and discovered where the reinvention of America can take place once again, just the way he did in 1832. So framed that way, we are a historical movement now of the creation of more and more associations that are the great producers of well-being. So it's a wonderful point you're making.
Well, thank you for saying that. And yeah, I think that is where our best hope is. That was the conclusion I came to when I sat down to write The Revolution Where You Live, was that,
yeah,
that is our best hope.
So Maggie, I'm wondering if this might be a moment to invite people in to call in, comment, question, chat. What do you say, Maggie?
Sure. Happy to do that. If you've dialed in to the conversation, you can press *8 and I will be able to acknowledge you. You'll be put into a queue. We've got some comments and in the chat. Well, we've got some additions in the chat. So please feel free to use the chat for your questions or comments. But we do, and we do have a caller. Just a second, please. Hello and welcome.
Hi, this is Norlin Dimmitt. I've been following the work of all three of you here for quite some time and just wanted to say, Sarah, what you're doing and what the Abundant Community is about and what Charter for Compassion is about and multiple other things that you're well aware of are all these silos of compassion. I don't mean silo, but I mean there hasn't been like the super deep collaboration between them that is kind of the reason we launched our tiny little Compassionate Citizens Foundation, not to do anything new, but to take all the stuff that's already happening and create a mechanism for both funding it and kind of incentivizing collaboration. Are you doing anything currently, or what are you doing with the Charter for Compassion, Compassionate Communities initiative?
Yeah, thank you for that. We are reaching out to a lot of different organizations, especially ones that have strong local chapters or a strong local presence, to say, you know, might your members want to take some of these trainings? Even if you're already offering the trainings in certain things, maybe there's some of the foundational questions of how do you work together locally that your members still might need, that you may not want to offer as a standalone kind of training. So we're offering that to a number of different national organizations, and we're also on the other side saying if there are things that you're already doing trainings in that you might want to share with a broader group, we'd also be happy to welcome you in to teach about that. So that's what we're doing right now. We haven't specifically reached out to Charge of Compassion, although I've had conversations about this project with some friends in Seattle who are working on that, and we've been talking about having, you know, further discussion about how we might work together. But we're still in the early stages. We actually don't launch this project until the end of September.
Oh, right. Well, I'm glad to get ahead of the curve here. So,
yeah.
I'm interested, before you get off the phone, tell us a little bit about the Compassionate Citizens Foundation. That sounds interesting.
Well, we've gone through a lot of iterations. I've basically done nothing. I'm still pre-revenue startup almost 2 years. 2 months from today would be, or yesterday is 2 years since I decided to donate Connection Realty to the Compassionate Community movement that was already being launched in Seattle. And it's the idea there is just to tap the last undisrupted financial service industry, the residential brokerage industry. We have recently taken a dramatic shift. We're looking at faith as a major asset in the ABCD model. We're looking at churches as being a great site for social transformation. It's always been. It's been part of civil rights and everything else, but to actually have it be part of the ABCD movement. But bottom line is we're in the process now of trying to convince RFP USA, which touches most people of faith in the country, Religions for Peace. If you go to RFP USA, it's 50 faith organizations, including the Catholic Church, the United Methodist Church, and so on, the larger Protestants, and 47 plus other faith bodies, to get them to be kind of the drivers of this common vision of uniting around the idea of compassionate citizenship, which I just got a notice from Charter for Compassion. They're now going to take on educating people to be compassionate citizens. And so this idea that that's something that can unite the Trump voter and the Hillary voter and the people that stayed home around the one common thread to all world religions and the secular humanists, basically, is that compassion counts. And we can come together around that bumper sticker, if you will. We've been doing dialogue across extreme diversity, Southern Baptists to atheists, for over a year now in our little pilot project. Doesn't generate any revenue. That's the problem at this point, right? But we've proven that the dialogue is actually very possible and people come in committed to respect.
That's really interesting.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for being here.
Maggie, anybody else in line?
Not just yet, Peter.
All right. Let me read. There are some things on the chat. Sarah's approach provides groups for in-person opportunities to see and be seen, hear and be heard, teach and learn from. So thank you for the comments you're writing in. Sarah, where do you use the word training, which I find interesting. And we're launching at the end of September. How are you marketing this? How are you getting the word out about your new project?
Yeah, so we're ramping up slowly because we don't want to be overwhelmed. And what we've heard from some other online training projects since the inauguration is that large numbers of people tend to sign up. So we want to start slowly as we're learning. And so we're not planning huge amounts of promotion at first. So we're doing outreach. I'm doing a number of talks around the country in October. So that will be a bit of outreach that way. We're working with these various partners, as I was mentioning to you. So some of the national organizations that have local chapters that they're working with, we're talking to them about whether there might be ways that we can collaborate and bring specific trainings to some of their membership. We'll be working on the social media side of things. Our website will be up by the end of September, and then we'll start building other social media around that. So we're doing it a little bit on the gradual side, in part because we also want to give the initial groups a lot of personal attention to make sure that our model is working really well for them. So we'll have each group will actually talk to an intake person, and They'll discuss what they're after, and that person will make sure that the trainings that they sign up for are the ones that really work for them and circle back later and find out how it went. And so as we do that, we plan to continue to improve the technology and the training methodology to make sure it works really well for people.
Yeah, because the real challenge with the online is a lot of people do sign up, and most of them disappear about as quickly as they signed up, you know. I saw something where 170,000 people signed up for a Harvard course and a very, very small number finished it. So Making experience powerful really is the big challenge, isn't it?
Sarah,
yeah, and I think
don't
part
know.
Of that is also how passive a lot of webinars are. So our methodology will include a lot of interactive processes in the room where you are with the other people. So instead of feeling like you're a passive recipient of somebody else's know-how, the trainers are really going to be inviting people to participate, to do small group conversations, to get up on their feet and, you know, form different kinds of formations within their group and then report back. And as they report back, they will be reporting back also to other communities around the country who are taking the same class at the same time.
All right. Sarah, can you give us an idea? This may be beyond where your planning is, but can you give us an idea of some of the skill training interactions or classes that you are thinking of putting on?
Sure. So one of the basic ones is how to have an ecstatic meeting. So instead of coming out saying, "I'll never go to another meeting again," you come out saying,
yeah.
wow, that was great. I know these people better. I feel heard. I learned things about my own community and other people, and I feel a deeper sense of connection, and I feel more powerful because I'm ready to move forward with these other people. So how to have that kind of meeting, how to navigate conflicts so that when things come up, because they inevitably do, that doesn't mean you're a failure or your group is a failure. It's just part of life. So how do you set yourself up so that when those things happen, you have really good tools so that you know how to move through those situations? Another one is setting goals for yourself and your group. Sometimes groups come together and people say, you know, we want to do something, but what is the right thing to do? Or there are so many things to do. How do you choose which to take on at any particular time? So how do you make those kinds of decisions? So those are sort of the basic set of core curriculum that we're starting off with.
Cool.
And it seems to me what the generic in my mind is that you're spreading the knowledge that people have of how to be collectively associated to achieve goals. It's the life of association face to face rather than the world of institution. And face to face, I think what we find is abundance. Institutionally, mm-hmm. we find scarcity. So I think it's a very important methodology for discovering abundance to have people face to face in the ways that you're helping them to engage each other.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And you and Peter have been big influences on me in that regard. That has, you know, I've been reading your work for years and also then testing it against what I see around me. And I just have felt that is so important and actually not is underappreciated, I think. I think too much of the political work has been a big organization that then asks its isolated members to do something, to call them to Congress or to do one thing. And those things are important to do, but they don't make you feel powerful. They don't make you feel like you're part of a movement or feel that you have the right to be a creative part of making change. And I think this moment we're in right now, we need that sense of power. We need that sense of abundance that we do have enough where we live to make the kind of world that we want.
And I think that's perfect. You know, last week I was with somebody who talked about the idea of economic isolation. And I like that term. And I think, you know, you talked about our isolation. We're so deeply isolated, we're going crazy psychologically, and we're also economically a little crazy because it's we act as if we don't have enough, and many people don't perhaps. But that's what I see you doing, is to try to kind of bring, you know, what the gentleman who called in said, the faith community, I think, will be a powerful participant in what we're doing, Sarah.
Yes, and I agree.
And I also hope the journalism world, you know, I've always held you up magically with yes and everything is, you know, your solutions, journalism. It's such a great alternative. I'm wondering, do you think it'll ever catch on? Is this what you're doing? And would you encourage me and lie to me and tell me that you think it will catch on? Because
I think it is catching on. I mean, I see more and more places where folks are doing that kind of journalism. So I think it is catching on. I think at the same time, that fear and hate and anxiety tend to provoke more attention, which tends to then feed into the business model of a lot of journalism. So there's kind of an addiction to that kind of negative stimulation, if you will. But I think a lot of people are really desperately looking for the positive stories as well.
It was an interesting weekend with Hurricane Irma. You know, it kind of, it was almost impossible not to watch, and I kept wondering what's so compelling, you know, about is this, you know, what's your thought about why watching the hurricane was so, both of you, I'd like to hear your thoughts on why you think it was so compelling.
Well, for me, it was partly a fear for people that I know and love, that I was afraid they were going to be harmed, and so
Yeah.
And there was so little predictability about what might happen to people. So there was a sense that, you know, that I don't know. There's this big unknown of what's going to happen to so many folks. So to me, it's a little different than the sort of salacious, you know, dwelling on the latest version in great detail of some horrible crime at the exclusion of the other aspects of
it. I think it was different. I do think it was different. It had a drama. I think as far as solutions journalism, we need to know how to write about what's working with the same kind of drama and uncertainty, maybe. But it also surprised me as how many people in Florida I know. You know, it's like, oh, I'm more connected to that state than I realize. John, mm-hmm. You have any thoughts about the hurricane and our interest in it?
The hurricane allows people to feel they can do something in a way. I noticed that a couple of the television stations make very clear how you can make contact in a way that you can contribute so that it is a medium for contribution at a distance that I think is very satisfying for people. I mean, they're not just hearing bad news. They're hearing about something that is a crisis, but they're being appealed to respond in at least in money and sometimes in person to do something. So that's the solution end of the equation that you hardly ever get in the media, but we're getting it this time.
That's great. That's cool. Anything else, Sarah, that you would like to share with us, or any little fragile thoughts you're having that you want to just throw out into the world and see what happens to them?
Well, just building on what John was just saying, I think people were so turned on seeing the Cajun Navy and the other person-to-person kinds of ways that people have pitched in to help each other out. You know, it's just so reassuring to know that people will turn up in an altruistic sort of way. They won't ask your bank account or your credit rating or, you know, your race or gender. They will just help out. And there's something deeply reassuring about that and even joyful. You know, Rebecca Solnit wrote that book, Paradise Built in Hell, I believe that's the title, about how happy people are in the midst of these kinds of disasters when they have an opportunity to pitch in.
Yeah.
And I found the same thing on my road trip. It wasn't going to disaster areas. I was going to places that were having chronic economic dislocation and so forth. But what I found is that when people came together to work together, there was this joy unleashed, whether it was Detroit or Louisville, Kentucky, or a reservation out west. There was some kind of joy that just you could just see it and feel it as soon as people came together to work on something together. And I think that's an untapped source of energy and power, the actual joy that people have, because then that's the energy that feeds this kind of revolution that we're talking about. And it's an energy that is fundamentally loving and nonviolent, and it's very powerful.
That's cool.
Excellent.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for the work you're doing. Thank you for including us in it. You know, I do think the lateral movement, the horizontal connections. I think it's very powerful, and it's very challenging to sustain it and keep it going. You know, we hold a lot of events in every community that are very exciting. You know, like Chuck Collins is coming to Cincinnati. But then when it comes to, okay, you have the event and 300 people showed up and they were touched. And, you know, how do you keep it, how do you make it something more than theater? That was something to remember. And I think maybe you're creating some of the connective tissue that would connect us between when we're gathering and then how do we stay connected. And you're kind of going to give us a way to do it. And I like the practicality that you're trying to bring to it. You know. And so I just appreciate what you're doing, Sarah, and the friendship. So thank you so much for joining us today. Any final
thoughts?
Thank you,
Peter, for being part of it. I really appreciate that. Yeah. And thanks for having me.
Well, Maggie, I assume nobody's waiting in line on the telephone.
Right, nobody's waiting in line.
Okay. John, any final thoughts? And then we want to thank people. And Maggie, you can take us out.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, I think of you as the wonderful exception I remember maybe 20, 25 years ago, I was asked to spend half a day with the leadership of the Chicago Tribune to talk with them about journalism and community assets. And it was a wonderful, interactive, sympathetic thing. And at the end, one of the people said, "But John, this has been wonderful, but you don't understand that what we mean by news is bad news. And this is not in our domain." And I thought, this is just crazy. You're saying you're reporting about society and you decided to report on the empty half of the glass. And the number of people in the world of journalism who have the perception you have of what it is we need to know to be a citizen, which is not how many people were killed on Tuesday. You contribute so much by being the model for what we do need to know rather than the popular media, which mostly is filled with what we don't. So thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate that.
Wow, well, this has been really great today. Sarah, I just want to add a couple of thoughts. As you were talking, you've mentioned a couple of times that one of the resources that People's Hub will provide is that of connection. And I know that in my work with Peter, we often think, hear something going on in one community and we want to connect them to another. I'm happy to know you'll have a database and hope we can work with you on that, because I think it's so valuable to be able to connect these people. So thank you. Thank you for that, and look forward to the future work with you on it.
So, wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it'll be cool. Appreciate your taking the time with us today, and thank you, everybody, for your comments, and Norlin for calling in. And we will have a recording of this on the website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and we'll also have a transcript of this as well. So to learn more about what Sarah's doing, you can go to revolutionwhereyoulive.org. Right now, we're in the process of scheduling our next one. So as soon as we know, we'll put it up on our website, which, again, is www.abundantcommunity.com. So stay in touch with us on the web and on Facebook. And thank you again for joining us today. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you all.